Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc webinar called Labor Law Reform on Capitol Hill, Opening Offer or Impasse. We're very pleased to welcome a terrific panel of legal experts today. Thomas Beck is currently Senior Advisor to Little Alert Mendelson's Workplace Policy Institute. Previously, he spent 13 years as Vice President of Labor and Employee Relations for HCA Healthcare. Mr. Beck handled the labor portfolio in both Trump presidential transitions, which included advising on workplace policy and recommending to the president-elect individuals to serve in senior leadership at the DOL, NROB, and EEOC. Roger Kane is the Senior Labor and Employment Counsel at CHRO Association. Mr. Kane specializes in labor and employment, healthcare, collective bargaining, contract administration, and representation campaigns. Vincent Vernuccio is the president and co-founder of the Institute for the American Worker. He previously served on the U.S. Department of Labor transition team for both Trump administrations and served in the George W. Bush administration's Department of Labor. Our moderator, Alex McDonald, is a shareholder and the co-chair of the Workplace Policy Institute at Little Alert Mendelson. With WPI, he advises employers on legislative, administrative, and regulatory developments at the state and federal level. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, her full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Mr. McDonald, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Sarah, and thanks for everybody who's tuning in today. I am confident you will not be disappointed in our panel today. A fun fact, I think everybody on this call has been asked by Congress to testify as an expert on labor reform. So we really couldn't have a better lineup today, and I am extremely excited to hear what these folks have to say. But before tossing it to the panel, I thought it might be helpful to sort of set the stage and lay out what do we mean by labor reform? Why are we talking about labor reform? How did we get here? Because frankly, labor reform, sometimes the term gets tossed about in the discourse as if it's one thing, but it's really not. Some of the bills and proposals we're going to talk about today in Congress, and maybe if we get there elsewhere, range from something like small tweaks around the margins to huge fundamental reforms of the way labor law works in the United States. Which raises the question, like why are we talking about this at this point? What is driving this energy behind labor reform? Why are there so many bills pending in Congress? And I think to understand that question, the first thing we have to start the conversation with the NLRB. So I think most people listening to a Federalist Society forum about labor law reform already know that the NLRB is the principal agency that administers national labor law. And you know, most of this audience probably also knows that the agency has been under quite a bit of strain in recent years. Its budget has been slashed, its volumes have surged, and its reputation has been in the dumps. And it's been in the dumps in part because of its own track record. Over the last 20 years, the board's decisions have gone through some, I think it's fair to describe, as pretty wild swings. During the Obama years, it reversed, at least according to one study done by CDW, more than 4,000 years cumulatively of its own precedent. During the first Trump administration, the board spent a lot of its energy walking those reversals back, restoring the wall to where it had been before the Obama board. And then when the Biden board came in, we got a series of this is my own view, but I think it's fair to describe as, however you view the merits of the policy, some pretty large earthquakes in labor law. Decisions like Thrive, which changed the way the board fashions remedies. Cases like Cimex, which changed the way that unions are certified as bargaining representatives. And cases like Amazon Services, which outlawed what until that point for decades had been a legal practice of union education meetings before an election. So all of that led us to a series of constitutional challenges, which have been filed all over the country. These lawsuits filed by private employers have challenged the board structure. Most of them have focused on board ALJs and the members, removal protections that are built into the statute for those folks. And some of them have found some initial purchase. So, at this point, we have at least one circuit in the country where the board is unable to process unfair labor practice charges. That's in the Fifth Circuit. And to top all that off, we had a board member who was terminated at the beginning of the Trump administration, Gwen Wilcox. Decision has been upheld by the D.C. Circuit. And as a result of that, for most of 2025, the board spent the entire year without a statutory quorum, meaning it couldn't really do much. And on top of all that, so that's what's happening at the board and is driving a lot of the discussion around labor reform. But we've also underneath that, which is maybe less noticed, but also really important, is a political shift. And what I mean by that is that at least since the 1930s, it's been true that labor unions have been thought of, fairly or unfairly, as an interest group associated with the Democratic Party. They, just by the numbers, they put their money and their muscle behind mostly Democratic candidates. That emphasis is reflected in the reception in Washington. Democratic congressional members typically favor pro-union legislation. Republican members generally oppose it. Again, it's not a perfect one-to-one, but that's generally the environment that we've been dealing with for about 50 years. But in the same time, what the numbers also tell us, public polling, voting, post-election polls, et cetera, tell us that union members and union households have been steadily but slowly shifting to the right. In both 2020 and 2024, Donald Trump outperformed prior Republican candidates in union households. And depending on which count you're looking at, he either won 40 or 43% of union households in 2024. That shift tells us something about the electorate. It tells us something about rank and file union members, so that even if union leadership hasn't quite made the shift, we are seeing a slide toward the right among union members, rank and file, and that is starting to be reflected in some of the policy proposals we've been seeing. That's a lot of setup to say, What labor reforms are we going to talk about today? What is Congress doing? How is it reacting to these trends? I'm going to run through some bills. There's a lot of bills, so don't feel like you need to take notes. This is all linked on the various committees' websites, but this is necessary to frame up what we're talking about and why we're talking about it. The big one, first out of the gate, I think the one that has gotten the most attention out of these bills, the Faster Labor Contracts Act. There's a lot of detail. That could be a webinar on its own, proposed by Senator Josh Hawley. Essentially, it requires first contract interest arbitration. Interest arbitration is where essentially an arbitrator writes a contract for the parties, rather than if they can't agree to it themselves. And there are very strict timelines in that act. That idea is not new. The new thing is that it's being proposed by a Republican senator. It has bipartisan support. But the actual policy comes from a few older Democratic bills, the Employee Free Choice Act in 2009 and the PRO Act, which has been introduced repeatedly. So that's the one that's gotten the most attention. But more recently, we've seen another package come out of the Senate led by Chairman Cassidy has proposed a series of bills. And I'll walk through these at fairly high level because we have limited time, but most of them could merit a longer discussion. There's the NLRB Stability Act. That act requires the NLRB to decide worker claims based on federal court precedent. The idea here is to end what's called the non-acquiescence doctrine, which is where the board just follows its own law until the Supreme Court tells it otherwise. That's the main thrust of that bill. There's the Fairness in Filing Act, which limits frivolous filings. And the idea is to help the board deal with its backlog. We all understand there's a huge backlog in part because the board hasn't had a quorum. The idea there is to prevent, you know, folks from just filing costless charges which have no merit on the ground. Essentially, you would have to file evidence along with your charge. There's the Union Member Right to Know Act. That act enhances worker access to information about how certain money is used, so that folks can know whether their dues are going toward political expenses. It would also create an opt-in structure for non-bargaining expenditures. This is all connected to a Supreme Court case called CWA v. Beck, which gave union members a right to opt out of non-bargaining expenses, including political expenditures. There's the Put American Workers First Act. That act is designed to protect American workers, as the policy is framed, by making it unfair labor practice to either unionize or to hire folks who are here without legal documentation. That one's pretty controversial. There's the Worker Privacy Act. That act protects workers who are engaged in the organizing process by preventing unions from using data collected through that process to for non-organizing purposes. There's the Worker Results Act. This one is aimed at strengthening the link between an election and a first CBA. This one is also fairly controversial. I think it's fair to describe because it would do things like eliminate the initial contract bar and the recognition bar by staying those doctrines until a first contract was signed. And then it would create a two-year rolling window where workers could elect a different union or fire their existing union. So those are a lot of bills over at the Senate. I know that was a lot of policy at a very high level, but I think it's also worth, before we dive into the panel's impressions, talking a little bit about there's another package that's introduced in the House to reform the LMRDA. These proposals are all aimed at Title I of the LMRDA, which is the Union Members Bill of Rights. Essentially, these are all strengthened or aimed at strengthening union member rights vis-a-vis their own unions. So there's, again, another Union Member Right to Know Act. This one would require the union to share certain documents like CBAs, union constitutions, bylaws, et cetera. There's the Ask the Union Members Act. This one requires secret ballot elections before a strike. There's Protecting the Union Representation and Election Act, the PURE Act. This one required union officers to be elected by secret ballot. And then there's the Union Endorsement Transparency Act, which this one, to me, is the, perhaps the most interesting. We can get into it later. This would require a union to poll its membership and then release the results of the poll before endorsing a candidate in a presidential election. I think, you know, no secret, the underlying policy, reading tea leaves, is probably related to what happened with Teamsters in 2024. They ultimately polled their members. Their members broadly favored the Republican candidate, and the Teamsters ultimately did not issue an endorsement that cycle. So that's a lot. Let me pause and then toss it to the panel. Guys, I just ran through a lot of bills. These bills all aim in some way or another to reform national labor law. So let's start. I want to actually hear from every one of you, starting with you, Roger. Does labor law need reform? And if so, what does need to change? Because we've got a lot of bills that are pushing in different directions.
So, Alex, an interesting question. Yes, to a point. But your partner the other day testified before the House Education and Workforce Committee, Brad Kelly, was asked essentially that question as it relates to AI. And I really liked his overall answer. He said the basics of the act work. The problem is that the act has not been administered in a consistent, thoughtful way. So I think the basic structure of the NRA still works. Now, Do we need to have different amendments considered? Absolutely. And beyond what you just indicated, I've identified at least 25 areas, I believe, Alex, that are in need of some discussion. And most particularly if the Supreme Court in the Slaughter case essentially reinforces the unitary executive theory and the president's right to summarily remove board members, EEOC commissioners, others in the executive branch. I think we need a labor court desperately to try to get independence and uniformity in the decision-making. But, you know, with all that said, Alex, I am not at all optimistic that we're going to see anything in the near term, given the very thin margins between the Democrat Party and the Republican Party, particularly in the House, where last I checked, it's 214 Democrats, 218 Republicans. So there's no margin for error there. If the Republican Party just loses two votes, that's a tie, and a tie in the House does not go forward. It's a defeat of the proposal. And of course, in the Senate, we have the filibuster rule requiring 60 votes to move legislation. I just don't see any movement on Capitol Hill in this Congress for any kind of changes in the NRA, LMRDA, or other labor and employment laws. The votes are just not there. It's too politically hot. House and Senate leadership will not proceed. So unfortunately, I think we have a very long way to go before we get any action out of Washington. Closing.
Yeah, Roger, you mentioned your labor court proposal, which I do want to circle back on. But let me ask you, Vinny. Again, we just ran through a lot of bills. There's a lot of energy behind this broad idea of labor reform. What's your view? Do we need labor reform? And if so, what kind of reform do we need?
Absolutely. And thanks, Alex. And thank you to the Federalist Society for including me. We absolutely need labor reform. I mean, the current labor law is vastly out of date. It was created for the Industrial Revolution. It's one size fits all. It's for unskilled workers working in factories. And frankly, it's keeping unions back because essentially it's giving them government crutches to not be professional service organizations that are really serving individual workers' needs. So the current major act in federal law, National Labor Relations Act, was from the 1930s. It was created for the Industrial Revolution. It doesn't translate in today's modern society. Now, with some of the bills that you were talking about, I would also add like the Employee Rights Act, which is kind of a smorgasbord of good ideas from Republicans. You know, as Roger said, a lot of them are either whittling away at the edges, doing much needed reform. You know, things like, you know, just saying you have to show evidence if you're bringing a unfair labor practice charge or having the NLRB actually follow court precedent. I mean, things that are extremely basic, and doesn't matter what side of the labor debate you're on, I think you can agree that those are good ideas. Two things that are admittedly a little bit of a heavier lift. But to go back to your question, yes, I think absolutely we do need labor reform. It may be forced upon us. We'll see what happens in the court cases. SpaceX in particular brought challenges towards the NLRB. Most recently, they are no longer under the NLRB's jurisdiction, but there are several other cases out there challenging the ability of administrative law judges at the NLRB to issue rulings. And frankly, the removal process and the ability of the NLRB to enforce its rulings without jury trial. So there may be stuff that comes from the court that actually forces Congress to open up the act and change the NLRB.
No, that's there's a lot there, Vinny. I want to come back a little bit on some of those legal challenges you mentioned, but let me toss it to Thomas. And Thomas, I want to start you out with the same broad question. I mean, we've heard some different views on, I mean, your other two co-panelists, that we do need labor reform. What is your view? Do we need it? And if we do need it, where should we be focused?
Well, I think there's maybe a couple of points I want to make here in response to your broad question. I love broad questions, Alex, because it allows us to talk about pretty much whatever we want. I agree with Vinny very much that it's the NLRA, the current federal labor law under which we're all operating, it is antiquated. It's a relic of an entirely different time, and it definitely needs reform, which I think will be very difficult, and we can get into really the odds of it happening. But when I look at the National Labor Relations Act, I see coercion directed all over the place, except at labor unions. And I ask, why is all of this coercion necessary? There's no longer involuntary servitude in these United States. You know, every employment relationship is voluntary, with workers free to accept or reject or walk away from employment they don't like and seek employment elsewhere. So what really is the compelling reason now for all the limitations on choice and freedom that are contained within federal labor law right now? Now, if a group of employees wishes to band together and attempt to negotiate collectively with their employer, I say, fine, let them. But why must the employer be legally mandated to negotiate with such a group? And why should other employees who choose not to join the group be bound by the preferences of the group? And if employees choose to deprive their employer of their labor, that is to say, if they go out on strike, why in the world should the employer be legally obligated to retain them as employees? It's really just absurd if you take a step back and think about this objectively. But over the last 90 years, all of these wildly unnatural and counterintuitive aspects of labor law have become viewed as really accepted and unremarkable. So, yeah, I think really fundamental reform is needed. I do think, let me try to quickly make this second point. In terms of the policy, you know, many, many people think the policy oscillation at the board and the board's non-acquiescence is a real problem. They think that's the board operating inconsistently with how it is supposed to operate and is intended to operate. The more I think about this, the less and less I see it that way. And I think I know a lot of labor lawyers, many I've practiced with over the last 30 years, who are brilliant labor lawyers. And they, you know, I think the mistake they make is they look at the NLRB and they kind of implicitly or subconsciously think it's like a district court that has to follow precedent and it has to be consistent. But that's not what the NLRB is. The NLRB is an executive branch agency that is tasked with determining and implementing policy. Now, it must do so within the confines of the act, of course, just like every federal agency must. But we all know that every statute is very much subject to interpretation, and the policy making and the policy determinations, it comes in there, it comes in those interstices in the act, right? Like, we know the act says good faith is required in collective bargaining, but what does good faith mean? That's very much subject to interpretation, and that can become a policy approach or policy implementation. And we know that the act protects concerted activity by employees, but what is and is not concerted activity? Well, that's something that is answered as a matter of policy based on what the preferences and goals of a given administration are. So I think it's a bit of a miss to think of the NLRB as anything other than an executive branch agency that is supposed to determine policy and try to achieve policy goals within the enacting statute that created the NLRB. And when the NLRB issues an order, it's not really an order. It's not self-executing. It's just a litigation position. The NLRB is a litigant. And when its orders are only enforced in federal court, and when it's in federal court, it is a litigant, and litigants are entitled to advocate for changes to precedent, and litigants are entitled to change their mind. So I have a little bit less problem with the policy oscillation because I have a different philosophical view of the NLRB. But I definitely think the National Labor Relations Act is antiquated and far too coercive.
Yeah, and I think we should come back to this policy oscillation question. It gets to one of the proposals that Roger himself has put forward. But Roger, right now I want to circle back to something else you said in your opening statement, about, you know, there not being space or political, you know, realities in Congress are going to make it difficult to get any of this stuff through. I want to challenge that a little bit and ask you to explain it, because, you know, I read through these bills to start, and some of them are, you know, I think I would, it's fair to describe as anodyne, right? So many of these bills are things like unions have to have a secret ballot election before they go on strike. Or, you know, the Union Members' Right to Know Act that Member Fox introduced just requires unions to share documents like CBAs and constitutions. Why do you think that kind of bill, which I think is frankly hard to argue with on the merits, who's against sharing documents like a CBA that's going to cover somebody? Why is it that those bills can't attract enough bipartisan support to move? And what's behind that? And why are we in such a state that something like sharing a CBA becomes too controversial to move through the House? Why are we in this state? And why do you say that it's just impossible to move these bills?
I totally agree. Objectively, we shouldn't be in this space, but we have at least 5 to 8 Republican House members that are heavily influenced by the Teamsters Union particularly, but building construction trade unions also, that have evidence that they will not consider, not vote for, support any type of meaningful labor legislation or Fair Labor Standards Act amendments or anything that's perceived to have any type of impact upon labor relations. And unfortunately, the House Education Workforce Committee has basically been neutered. The chair is very frustrated, I know. It is a process where there aren't votes even to get bills out of that committee. And on the Senate side, the filibuster 60-vote requirement, of course, is a very high ladder for anyone to climb. And when you throw in that mix, Senator Hawley, and the impact that the union movement has upon his voting record, and particularly the Teamsters Union, Alex, we are at an absolute stalemate. And what I wanted to add at the beginning is that the action, unfortunately, in labor law, so-called reform, is in the states, the blue states, and the state legislative bodies and local governmental entities have taken upon themselves to pursue what they believe to be appropriate labor law reform. So I think we're at an absolute stalemate. Midterm elections make everyone more cautious also. So I like our discussion today, but I think as a political reality, there's little appetite politically in the House or the Senate to move any bill that has labor and employment change.
Yeah. So, Roger, you mentioned Senator Hawley, and it's a bit of the elephant in the room. Vinny, I actually want to ask you about this. So I mentioned that Senator Hawley has introduced the Faster Labor Contracts Act, was first out of the gate among the bills that we ran through in the beginning. And look, I mean, a lot of the bills are, you know, marginal changes. You follow labor politics in this town pretty closely. I mean, do you read any of these bills as a reaction to the Faster Labor Contracts Act? Is this coloring the debate we're having, or should we really be thinking about these independent policies?
Just going back to what Roger was talking about, you know, the chairs of both committee, Chairman Wahlberg on the House side, Chairman Cassidy on the Senate side. When you look at their packages, you know, these aren't, you know, really rabid red meat issues. You know, Alex, as you were saying, you know, we're talking about the secret ballot. We're talking about following court precedent. We're talking about, basically federal rules of civil procedure. So, you know, a lot of these are really small changes, and they do look like they are meant to bring the caucus together and say, OK, let's get something that everybody can agree on. And, you know, when you take the, well, this is your team versus my team, and you look at a lot of things in the Cassidy package, the Wahlberg package, you know, they're pretty bipartisan, for lack of a better term. Then you go to the Fair Faster Labor Contracts Act. And I want to start off with a quote before I describe it. This would remove democracy from the workplace. This is the whole point of the union, because it gives workers a say. And Alex, I know you're probably very familiar with that quote because it was at a Senate hearing. But that was from a machinist union shop steward who was the Democrat witness, who is supposed to be backing Faster Labor Contracts Act. And when Chairman Cassidy described what the Faster Labor Contracts Act did, which is saying that a government-appointed arbitration panel could write a first contract between an employer and a union without a vote of the workers if they don't reach an agreement within 90 days, that it was just, wait a minute, no, this isn't right. So you have, you know, those sort of extremes, and then you look at things like the PRO Act, and, you know, I think that's where there's oscillation. But when you come back to these bills, a lot of them in that Senate package, a lot of them in that House package. And, you know, I'd love to talk a little bit more later on about the Employee Rights Act. You know, it seems like it could be things that if you take, well, this is your team versus my team, oh, out of it, there could be a meeting of the minds. You know, going along with what Roger said, it's going to be a lift for all the reasons Roger said. But, you know, if you strip that out of it. And the last thing I will end with for this question is, granted, we didn't go back as far as that great CDW study with the policy oscillation at the National Labor Relations Board. But when you look at the amount of pro-worker legislation that was introduced in this Congress, you know, I'm not including Faster Labor Contracts Act in that. But, you know, the Cassidy package, the Wahlberg package, Employee Rights Act, things like the Worker Enfranchisement Act, and, you know, things that are giving those individual workers rights. There has been more pro-worker legislation introduced this Congress since any time since the 90s and probably even before that. So, you know, for a labor policy wonk like me, it is incredibly exciting times.
Yeah, no, that's a great response. And I think that you are putting your finger on the pulse here of what's driving some of these changes and why we're seeing the shape of labor proposals taking what they are. But Thomas, I do want to shift over to you for a little bit. I'd like your take on the same question, or at least a similar question, which is, I mean, what is your read on the political, you know, atmosphere? Why are so many of these proposals really marginal changes? Because I think everybody, including you in your opening statement, was aiming at something a little bit broader when they're talking about labor reform. Is this a product of the Faster Labor Contracts Act? And do any of these bills stand a chance in Congress?
Well, I think that last part of the question is pretty easy. I think right now, effectively, virtually no kind of labor law reform stands a chance. You know, I've followed this over the years now, and the interests are so clearly delineated and so entrenched when it comes to labor law or anything related to the regulation of labor management relations that politically, labor law reform, while, you know, most of the country maybe wouldn't be that interested in it or really understand some of the stuff that's going on because they don't live with it like we all do. Nevertheless, politically in Washington, D.C., it's almost as controversial as polarizing as abortion always has been and transgender rights has become in recent years. I mean, it's just incredibly polarizing. And the sides, the tribes are sort of in their opposing corners and they just won't give an inch. Now, what is interesting, and so I think for that reason, labor law reform, I don't see it for the next two or three or four cycles. You know, it can't be done through reconciliation. I think we're going to keep the filibuster in the Senate for a while. And as long as we have the filibuster in the Senate, any reform would have to get 60 votes. I don't see that in the next two, three or four cycles, probably. I don't see a majority of 60 that would vote for labor law reform. I don't know that these are really responses to the Faster Labor Contracts Act. I think a lot of legislation There are many proposals, and I kind of share Vinny's excitement about it, about all that's going on here. There's this little bit of a realignment, though, where Republicans are doing so much more pro-worker, which is just the result of the Republican Party. It's getting votes now from less educated working people. And so what we're seeing in terms of Republicans supporting sort of what is generally perceived as pro-worker legislation, that's just, I think, a natural consequence of Republicans needing and obtaining much more kind of working class support than they ever have. But I still don't think, notwithstanding that, though we see a little more alignment between Democrats and a few Republicans, I still don't see getting the kind of majorities needed to actually pass this labor law reform.
Yeah, that seems to be the consensus here. So, Roger, I'm going to circle back to you. We've now got every panelist telling us that this stuff can't move right now or won't move. What could change that? I mean, so I think you, during your opening statement, mentioned the Slaughter case. The Slaughter case is the case being considered by the Supreme Court right now involving an FTC member who was removed. That involves the president's power to unilaterally remove the heads of the quote-unquote independent agencies. So there's that case pending out there. There's also the cases out there about the board's ALJs. Should we be looking at something else? Could any of that change the energy in Congress and make the likelihood of labor reform moving forward more likely, or do we need something else?
Well, Alex, that's the one outlier. That's the one area where I think we have a slight chance of the Congress reacting to what the Supreme Court is expected to do, i.e. uphold a very strong unitary executive authority for the president to summarily remove members of the National Relations Board, et cetera. That triggering event, assuming the court decides the case as I just described, may be enough to garner Republican and Democrat votes to preserve a national labor policy, which we need, through a labor court. And I think we all should probably back up here a moment. Yes, there needs to be some changes in the NLRA, but the act overall, as I said in my opening statement, has served this country well. It has brought industrial stability. It has permitted parties to come together where appropriate to bargain collectively. It has many positive attributes. We cannot have the law of the jungle in this country. We need to have national labor policy, and we need to have an adjudicative body that fairly and impartially, to the extent possible, decides disputes. That's the proposal that I and two of my colleagues from the academic community have made. An Article I labor court, six judges, two of whom would be Republican, two of whom would be Democrat, and two independent. And there are more than sufficient qualified people to meet that independent definition, by the way. The American Arbitration Association has over 400 arbitrators, et cetera. But whatever we come up with, we need to have this national policy of resolving peacefully and thoughtfully and hopefully impartially labor disputes. Final point I'd make, the National Labor Relations Board, for all its problems, does decide 80 to 90% of the cases on a uniform basis without dissent of a Republican or Democrat member. It is one of the more efficient agencies in federal government, and it does process cases and come to conclusions. I mean, Vinny, Thomas, and I all would point out any number of problems with certain policy decisions of the board, no doubt about it. But I think when we step back, we have to look at what are we wanting to achieve here. And I think a uniform federal labor law approach is critical. And back to your baseline question, Alex, I think the decision in the Slaughter case might be enough of a trigger to have the Congress undertake some meaningful action.
That's a good response. And Vinny, I want to shift to you and ask a similar question, but I'm going to introduce another element to it. We know that the board needs three confirmed members to do anything, to exercise its statutory powers. And we just recovered a three-member quorum with the two most recent appointees. But in August, Member Prouty is going to roll off, and we're going to have we're going to be down to two members unless we get some other nominees and confirmations. Is that the kind of thing that could shake loose some members in Congress to move forward? Or do we, in fact, and I think you also mentioned the litigation, need some kind of, I'll describe it as a crisis point in the courts to get action from Congress? What's your view on that?
I think for real fundamental change, it's either going to have to be build slowly, and I agree with everything that Roger and Thomas already said, or it has to hit a crisis point. I'm not sure that NLRB losing quorum again is going to do that. And, just looking at the NLRB, and, if the question is what is going to change, I think we're going to see a lot of stuff regulatorily, whether it's NLRB, whether that's the Department of Labor. The NLRB quorum may actually be a misnomer, and I'm not really sure what is going to happen there. I think a lot of people are looking at it because, Alex, as you know, NLRB has a tradition of needing three votes to overturn precedent. Right now, there's two Republican votes, one Democrat vote. So even though there is a quorum, there's not that three votes. But remember, it's a tradition. It's not the law. Both Republican members during their confirmation hearings said, we are going to uphold that precedent, but we will see what happens. But as far as what could actually change in the very near term, I'm keeping my eye on the Department of Labor. The regulatory agenda has things in the short term, like the independent contractor rule, which is desperately needed, bringing stability and assurance to people that are working for themselves, that the government is not going to come after them and say, no, you're actually an employee, you can't do that. To joint employer, which is on the long-term agenda, to make sure that companies can work with their employees and another company that does not have that direct control, controls those employees, to, a host of other things that were already brought up. Secret ballot protections at the National Labor Relations Board, free speech at the NLRB, and stopping the NLRB from prohibiting employers from talking to their employees. So there is a host of issues that are coming down that Congress will not have to address immediately, because they think that's going to happen regulatorily.
No, that's a really good point. Thomas, I want your take on that. So we've been talking a lot about congressional proposals to change or amend or fix or cover holes in labor law. How much of this could the board itself, assuming we have a functioning board for any appreciable amount of time, handle itself? And in your mind, what parts of this would be appropriate for board action that could be taken care of at a regulatory level, as opposed to waiting for Congress to act, which sometimes feels like doing a brain dance?
Well, I think most of what I'm going to offer is my personal opinion. But in my personal opinion, a lot of what needs to be done in extant labor law can be done at the board. It is the board that has always defined what is the obligation, what is really meant by and what is encompassed by the obligation to collectively bargain and to do so in good faith. And that has evolved. Well, I should say the board and the courts define these things, but the board is the starting place. So the board could tee up really meaningful reform on quite a few issues that are pretty core to labor management relations. They could redefine and narrow what really is meant by the obligation to bargain in good faith. And they could define out of that obligation, for example, the obligation to provide all sorts of information and make all sorts of disclosures to one's negotiating counterparty, which really doesn't happen. That's not really a legal obligation anywhere else in Anglo-American jurisprudence. But it's one that is an interpretive invention that the board and the courts have implied in the National Labor Relations Act. Similarly, and perhaps more importantly, the obligation to maintain status quo for an employer, the obligation to avoid any unilateral changes in terms and conditions of employment while bargaining. This gives a labor union veto power over over an employer's ability to manage its workforce. And I just don't think, I just do not believe that when Congress passed the Taft-Hartley amendments to the National Labor Relations Act in the late 1940s, just as the American economy was moving from a war footing to a footing of consumerism, and it was extremely dynamic, I just really don't think that that Republican majority Congress intended to give labor unions veto power over employers' ability to manage their workforce. But in through a series of board decisions and court decisions, most notably the NLRB v. Katz decision from the Supreme Court, you know, there's this obligation to maintain status quo and never unilaterally change any terms and conditions of employment. Well, the act doesn't say that. So the board could begin the reinterpretation of what is meant by good faith bargaining. They could reinterpret what is encompassed by what is really included or not included within protected concerted activity. And this is where we've seen a great deal of policy oscillation over the last 15 or 20 years, right? What is PCA? And so, you know, what is employer free speech? I mean, the Biden board essentially eliminated employer free speech. There is such an enormous presumption now in labor law that everything employers do is coercive, and employees are constantly running around feeling coerced and oppressed. And I think that's a relic of an earlier time. It might not have ever been accurate, but I don't think it's accurate now. And so reinterpreting and sort of breathing some new vigor into employer free expression that is protected by the First Amendment and the Act, that's also something the board could do. So there are changes that would really mean a lot to leveling the playing field that the board could do simply by interpreting the Act.
Yeah, no, that's a great response. I think that's all right and within the board's purview. I want to take there's a question from the audience, and I think this is mostly aimed at you, Roger, and I'm going to take it in a little bit of a different direction. So they ask about your proposal for a labor court, and then whether it would be realistic to think any of the nominees could be considered independent. But I think that gets to a more fundamental thread that's been running through our entire discussion, which is, and I know, Vinny, you referred to, you know, Republican nominees and Democratic nominees, which is descriptively correct. But theoretically, the members of the board are supposed to be serving the public. That was the original idea. And so I wonder, looking at this package of bills and some of the oscillation that we've all referred to, how much are we seeing, and I'll direct this to you, Roger, sort of a transformation both in the way that labor law is being conceived in Congress and the way it's being treated at the board as a more partisan subject than perhaps it was in the past. It was always, I think, a little bit tinged. But are we seeing a change in kind in the way folks think about and talk about labor laws such that we can't think of members as independent? We think of them as representing political parties? Or is this recoverable? Is there something we could do from a labor law reform standpoint that would walk back this, what I think is fair to describe as an increasingly partisanly tinged subject and environment?
I think we've passed the point of no return on policy issues at the board. But again, I mean, that's only a, you know, 5% of the board's inventory of case decisions. But unfortunately, the board on policy issues and those 5% of the cases that we really are concerned about have become just a political battleground between labor and management. And I take issue with whoever suggested that we cannot find independence. The proposal we have would not permit anyone to be classified as independent if he or she had represented union or management over a 4+ year period. There are people out there that can independently think. Now, is it going to be a perfect world where everything will be harmonized in federal labor law? No, but it certainly would provide a footwork, a background, or a approach, if you will, for a more stable decision-making process and minimize the political partisan impact. And policy oscillation is a problem, as Thomas mentioned. There are many other issues like what is good faith bargaining, as he mentioned, that can be decided on the facts by good, thoughtful decision makers. So we need a labor court. And the bottom line is the present structure of the board, including ALJs and the way they function, the lack of procedural safeguards, et cetera, need attention. But Alex, at bottom, we're going to have to redo the structure to keep a federal labor law system intact in this country. And again, preemption's an issue. We haven't really touched upon that. But again, the state's intrusion, particularly New York and California, improperly, as the courts have held so far, into our federal labor law is a concern. And finally, our members at HR Policy, which are most of, or CHR Association now, which are most of the Fortune 400 companies in the country, they have operations in jurisdictions throughout the country. They do not want 50 labor laws. They want a uniform federal approach. So that's important. So preemption and preserving a federal labor law model, we have to pay attention to.
Now, I like that you ended on that point. And Vinny, I want to ask you about this too. I think for better or worse, most of the discussion today is focused on things that Congress has proposed to do but probably will not do. Do we run the risk, the risk that Roger's describing at the end of his remarks, that if Congress doesn't act or is unable to act, or we've come to a place where we pass the point of no return, it's too partisan, et cetera, are we risking a situation where there becomes a space for states to step in and, you know, over the course of, you know, however many years it takes, we end up with 50 labor laws or at least 50 labor regimes? And in your mind, is that a realistic risk? And how bad would that be, if bad at all?
So I don't think that is realistic in the near future. The National Labor Relations Act very clearly has preemption on a host of issues. You know, there are exemptions. Right to work is the classic one, but that's written directly into the act. There's things like project labor agreements with, if you're talking about states acting as market participants, that is up for debate. There's also states like Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, and I believe a bill just passed yesterday out of the Senate in Mississippi that would protect the secret ballot for workers that were getting state at companies that were getting state incentives. So there are things around the edges that are likely legal and are very explicitly legal by Congress. However, as far as what we're seeing coming out of New York, California, you know, and some of the other attempts of creating mini state NLRBs, that is probably going too far, and that is very likely preempted. And Alex, if I can just take a little bit of a privilege here. I know we've talked about a lot of bills, and there's a lot out there. And, you know, like I said, for a policy geek like me, it is an incredibly exciting time. If the audience wants to know more about all of these bills, on our website, i4aw.org, under resources, we have our pro-worker agenda. And we've actually had Austin Bannon, one of our senior fellows, also works at AFP, go through each and every one of these bills and break them down. And all of that is on i4aw.org in a very handy kind of encyclopedia of all things labor policy. So audience can go there. And if they want to hear more on the true pro-worker perspective, we're actually flying three different workers in to Washington, D.C. next week. And on the 19th at the Capitol Visitor Center, we are having a pro-worker policy seminar for Hill staff, stakeholders, and others that if they're in the D.C. area, they can email me, Vinny at i4aw.org, V-I-N-N-I-E at i4aw.org, and we can get them a free lunch in the audience and hear the true pro-worker perspective on a lot of these issues.
I think that may be a first that we've had free lunches offered on a FedSoc webinar. So makes you for setting a precedent. But I actually do second that folks who are interested in these subjects should visit i4aw.org. It's a great resource. They do a lot of great work over there. Though, you know, we're running up against time and time, so I want to give you a chance to get the last remarks in here. I mean, so we've talked about, you know, the stall that we all expect in Congress. This felt need for labor reform and this move by some states to fill the gap. I mean, what is your perspective on this? If we can't get the action, then I think there's a consensus, at least, that we need some action on this call. What is the risk that we see labor law become increasingly a question of state law? And how does that change labor policy in this country?
I think I agree with what I believe Vinny said, which is, you know, substantial changes or substantial intrusions from the states are unlikely. I think the preemption, the federal preemption, is pretty clear. People have suggested to me recently that the Supreme Court, the current Supreme Court, may be a little skeptical or a little, you know, a little soft on federal preemption in labor law matters. I don't know. I'm guessing that they would have no interest in undoing Garmin or Machinists or really revisiting in a significant way those decisions. I think they make great sense, those decisions, and we've all relied on them for a very long period of time. So I think, as Vinny said, I really agree with him. I think there may be some change. There may be some sort of nibbling around the edges. States may do things that, you know, that maybe some of us would like and we would not like, you know, depending on the state. But I think it'll be sort of nibbling around the edges. And I do think the real regulation of labor management relations is going to stay with the NLRB. And I think preemption will be around for a while. We, of course, have states intruding into the workplace in many, many other ways, like trying to turn gig workers into employees over and over and over again. But that's not sort of classic traditional labor law. I think this is a great discussion. I've really enjoyed the panel and your moderation and the issues. And for people who live with these issues, this is so fascinating. But I think, you know, I just think, to borrow a phrase from a term of art from labor law, I think we're kind of going to be stuck with status quo for a while. I think we're not going to see significant labor law reform, probably any labor law reform. I think we're going to keep the NLRB as it is. It's going to be structured as it is. I think we're going to continue to see policy oscillation. And, you know, on the one hand, that frustrates a lot of us. On the other hand, it also keeps us employed in different ways. So I think that's the reality of kind of where we are. And something that I have trouble anticipating, something very unpredictable, would have to happen to really lead to change in the current structure or how labor management relations are governed in this country.
Great. Well, I think we could go for another 2 hours on these subjects, but we should give the audience respite, a little bit of a rest, and I'll toss it back to Sarah to close us out. But thank you very much to this panel, and thanks for everybody who tuned in.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you. Well done.
Yes, thank you, Alex, and thank you, Sarah and FedSoc.
On behalf of the Powerless Society, thank you so much to Mr. Back, Mr. Kane, and Mr. Vernuccio for speaking with us today, and to Mr. McDonald for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.